Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. And shalom, and welcome to the Land of Israel Network, Land of Israel Radio, founded Land of Israel, thelandofisrael.com. I always forget the, because I get so excited about the Land of Israel without the. Anyway, add the, thelandofisrael.com. Shalom, and welcome. And shalom, and welcome to Malka Fleischer, show hostess with the mostest. Yay. Shalom.
Thank you, Yishai. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you on the show today, although I must be honest in telling everybody that this week I did not have the pleasure of going to see Rabbi Mike Foyer and recording our spiritual cafe, and I wanted to do other radio things, but the truth is that this show is could be titled Yishai's Got a Flu. And Yishai is at home sick. So we are at home, and you've graciously, magnanimously, and very wife-like agreed to do radio with me. I appreciate that very much. But the truth of the matter is that I feel not well right now, and I'm sickly. Thank you, God, for every sickness and every little thing. So much kapara, so much, what's it called, kapara?
Little suffering atonements.
Atonements, little atonements that we have to have in our life, and this is one of them. You know, if we're, you know, I just couldn't not, I could have easily just laid in bed and watched yet another movie, but I just felt that I desperately wanted to get out a little bit of radio, especially because of the incredible Torah portion, which is just so, so fundamental. And also because of what's happening this week, which is the inauguration of President Trump, in the United States of America, which has some kind of a real global effect, and certainly effect here on Israel. I don't know. I feel it. I'm feeling it. I'm like feeling this thing.
Right. Well, I want to start with the cold thing and say that I've done my best, listeners. I know that Yishai has a cold, but I've done my best. I've been feeding him vitamin C and zinc. Also, Israeli scientists discovered that there's this plant called the elderberry plant that you're supposed to use its extracts. It really helps you with colds and. There's this product out there. There's a few now, but there's one called like Sambucol or something like that. It's from this plant. So I've been trying to give him these little effervescent tablets in water with this elderberry extract in it.
Oh, is that what that stuff is?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's based on Israeli science. Did you know that?
Oh, wow.
Do you feel better already?
Yeah.
And what else? I've been making you good breakfasts.
Yes.
I bought orange juice.
Yes.
I've been feeding you clementines.
It's true.
I'm trying. Also, I made you lie down.
It's true. I'm not feeling so good, and I really appreciate the warmth and goodness that you've showered upon me.
I think Hashem, we all know how men are when they're sick.
Right. They have a picture that you've used, and this week's Torah portion is very much about childbirth as well. There's you've given a lecture about Jewish spirituality and childbirthing. Because you are also a doula.
That's right.
What does the word doula mean anyway?
It is honestly a Greek word. I don't remember what it means, but it's basically for a support, like a supporter.
Uh-huh.
And I am a birth coach. Yeah, I learned birth coaching.
You're like a social media mogul, a brand manager, and a birth coach.
Yeah, I get to use both sides of my brain, which is really cool. I'm very grateful for that. Anyway, so I think what you were about to say is that there's this really great meme. And anyone who wants to know about the meme can either like message me on Twitter or on Facebook. I'm on Twitter and on Facebook, and you can find me there. I'll try to find this meme. But it's like, it's a picture of a woman, and she's clearly like in the pains of childbirth. And it says like, wow, this really, really hurts almost as badly as it is, as it would hurt if I was a man who had a cold. Because that is how men treat their colds.
Yeah.
It's like women get a cold and it's like you still got to do carpool and you still got to make dinner and you still got to do your job, whatever it is that you do. And you got to fold the laundry and you got to get your hair brushed and your teeth brushed and all that stuff. But men, they're like, why has this happened to me? What does this all mean? Who am I? I thought I was stronger than this. Oh, no, I've been brought so low.
It's true.
And then
it's
they true. Just crash. It's no true. Offense, Yishai.
No, none taken. It's just, there's a lot of truth in that. And it's pathetic. In any case, let's go on.
But you're doing okay. I want to give you a solid B grade. You're doing well. You're definitely going to pass. Even more than pass, because you went past D and C.
I hate
all the
B.
way to B.
I hate B. In any case, let's keep going. Let's just let
Wait,
it
Isha,
be.
You should tell everyone about your neti pot. Everyone wants to hear about that.
No, Alex Trayman gave me a neti pot to use. He showed me how to use a neti pot. It's a way to like clean out your sinuses. But the truth of the matter is I think I have some kind of like low-grade flu here. So it's, the sinuses are just one part of it. I just feel generally weak and achy.
Well,
and
in
weird.
Israel, there is a lot of sickness going around. Tons and tons of kids are just like, the tissue industry is booming here. Tissues are at the front of the stores. Everyone's selling tissues because everybody is sick. I think part of it has to do with the fact that it is wintertime. And the other part has to do with the fact that it's not really raining as much as it could.
Yeah. Everybody listening to the show has got to stop, drop, and pray and do a little bit of like, we need more rain in Eretz Israel. It's just not precipitating.
We do live in Eastern Jerusalem, which is right on the edge of the desert. Basically, we're on one side of a mountain, the Mount of Olives. And if you were to go to the other side of the mountain, literally, then you would see desert. It's desert on the other side. So we definitely get the least rain probably of the whole Jerusalem area, and other areas of Jerusalem are getting more. But we do need rain, and I need to ask a particular favor. This is a precipitation prayer request. Here it is. My children need some snow, okay? I know that there are people around the world who are complaining that they're getting so much snow and ice and blah, blah, blah. Oh, no, no, it's snowing. I'm telling you right now, the children of Jerusalem are crying into their little pillows because they need some snow. It's been already, last year there wasn't a good snow, and the year before that there wasn't a good snow. We need a good snow here in Jerusalem. It's the middle of January. There's still time, okay? So please, just take a moment. You can also, I totally accept this kind of prayer also. Dear God, we have too much snow here in Minneapolis. Please transfer 5 inches of our snow to Jerusalem. That is a win-win situation for you. You pray for us to get the snow that you don't want.
Very good. Okay, so we're praying for the snow in Jerusalem, and it's hard to transition out of that. And because I'm sick,
we could talk about other things that are going to descend into Jerusalem.
Well, the first thing
they're going to waft so beautifully into the crisp air of Jerusalem, like the Jerusalem Embassy.
Like the Jerusalem Embassy, which wants to waft its way down to
the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem.
Yeah. So I was on TV this week, at the beginning of this week, before the illness hit me, and
the illness.
Yeah. And I was on I-24. And the one thing that I said that they really were very excited about was that I said, look, President Donald Trump is not going to be moving the embassy to Jerusalem. That's just not correct phraseology. The real truth is that the American people have voted in the Embassy Act of 1995, Jerusalem Embassy Act, to move the embassy to Jerusalem. That's the will of the American people. And it is American presidents who have obstructed that by recurrently signing a waiver every 6 months to kind of negate that very law that was passed by the people of America, two houses of Congress, and one president. And now when that waiver comes in front of President Donald Trump, we're certainly hoping that he will not sign it and that the automation of the law will begin, meaning to say the fulfillment of that law. And that's a lot of excitement. And the Palestinian Authority has answered that potential reality by saying, if the United States will move its embassy to Jerusalem, all kinds of hell are going to open up. It'll open up the doors of hell.
Right. I believe that. I believe that for a couple of reasons. One, because I definitely think that it will enrage Arabs, particularly locally, but also worldwide. I think it will really feel like a threat to the message that they've been sending, which is that Jerusalem is something that should be definitely at least partially Arab for now, but certainly not only Jewish. They have spent millions and millions of dollars in man hours just on this message while their people are dying left and right from all kinds of various problems, including infighting. They spend their time making sure that the Jews don't have all of this one city on earth called Jerusalem. I just want to say, by the way, Yishai, that there was a report in Israel National News I saw that Donald Trump, you were saying that you hope that he doesn't sign the waiver again. So somebody from Israel Hayom, which is an Israeli newspaper, spoke with President Trump.
President-elect Trump.
Which still sounds weird to say. Anyway, over the next few days, and he reminded him that he had made this promise to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. So this guy, his name is Boaz Bismuth. He said, "You haven't forgotten your promise about the embassy in Jerusalem." And so Trump responded to him. He said, "Of course I remember what I told you about Jerusalem. Of course I haven't forgotten. And you know I'm not a person to breach promises," answered Trump. He also said, "I can't wait to start working with Israel. At the end of the week, the relationship between us begins in earnest." So he's definitely interested in what's going on here. I don't love the conversation so much about Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, being like the best broker of a deal. I'm not sure we need someone to broker a deal. I still don't like that ethos where some country comes in from the outside and helps Israel and its enemy figure stuff out. I think that we can figure our own stuff out, and I think that we should broadcast that message both to the enemy and to countries around the world. I don't know where Jared Kushner actually stands on the important issues.
What Jared Kushner thinks? It's what Ivanka thinks. And Ivanka is like a kosher cake-making, quasi-Chabadi.
Right. Do you know what her Hebrew name is, by the way? I found this out today.
I want to know.
So there's more news about the Trumps. And I want to preface this by saying that
I'm not a Trump troll.
We're gonna stop talking about the Trumps after a while. Meaning to say they're not our president. Israel has its own politics, its own issues, its own leaders, and its own concerns. But this transition into a potentially very pro-Israel U.S. government is very attractive to the average Israeli. Really, I mean, the average man on the street is very excited about that. Whether he'll be good for America and all kinds of various particular policies, we can't say, right? And we're not that we don't care about you, we really do, but we're not so concerned with that. We're really concerned with how this affects us here in Israel, naturally. So the Trumps are basically fascinating. But basically, there was another article that I read about this morning that the Trumps, the Kushners, I guess, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, they are going to the inauguration on Friday, and they want... it will start, like, at certain points, Shabbat will come, right? So then they have to deal with that, right, in a, like, religious way. And they basically went to a rabbi and they got a heter, which is a dispensation, to travel in a car on Shabbat. And I'm sure that this will be worked out in a halachic way. They have permission to go in a car on Shabbat because of pikuach nefesh, because of threats to their lives. Basically, because they are such
prominent people
who need to be guarded by guards, that they need to be able to ride in cars on Shabbat. Now, a scoffer might say, "Oh, look, how religious are they? I mean, they're going to do this and they're going to do that." I just want you to know that there are other people who ride in cars on Shabbat. There are two different types of people that I want to highlight. One are soldiers, right? Israeli soldiers, they ride in cars on Shabbat. They have a dispensation to do that when it comes to issues pertaining to security. And I know this personally because I know a lot of these people, Jerusalem and Israeli healthcare professionals, people like nurses, for example. There are many nurses living here in our neighborhood, and they ride in cars on Shabbat. Why? Because the people in hospitals, it's pikuach nefesh. If there's no nurses, and nurses don't feel like they can, in a halachic, in a Jewish legal fashion, travel from work to home, they will not do that. They won't travel. And then these people will be left without the health care that they need. And so, in conclusion, to get a dispensation to ride in a car on Shabbat is not that big of a deal. It is doable, and they just did it. And so, Yael Trump Kushner will be riding in a car with her Jewish kids and her Jewish husband to her non-Jewish but pro-Jewish father's festivities for inauguration.
I want to tell you, you said pro-Jewish. You know, I was thinking today that there's really, I'm going to say this in the roughest way possible. There's two kinds of goyim. There's two kinds of Gentiles.
All right.
Ohev Yisrael and Sonei Yisrael. There's also a third kind, which is don't know nothing
yeah,
about
it. Yeah, they're not related.
But
yes.
But when it comes to like Jews, when it comes to Gentiles and the relationship to Jews, in Hebrew we don't say Ohev Yehudim, likes Jews. We say Ohev Yisrael. Do you love Israel? Are you an Ohev Yisrael? And I dare say that the people listening to this show, Jews and Gentiles, are certainly my Gentile friends are Ohave Yisrael, lovers of Israel. Lovers of Israel. Lovers right. of Israel means the whole kit and caboodle. Jews right. with all of their maniacal problems, Israel with all of its complexities, and God, God bless him, but with his complexities as well.
Yes.
With his complexities right. as well. That's an Ohev Yisrael. And then I was just thinking about some Arab Knesset members that we have, which are Sonei Yisrael. Sonei Yisrael. Right. I could just, and I was, I imagined myself, like I was imagine myself just arguing against one of these
yes.
Knesset members in a studio.
That's what we all something. Do in the shower, Isha.
Right, right. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I was like, "Atas Sonei Israel. You're like an Israel hater. Like right. everybody could see that. Your whole behavior is that you hate Israel. You hate Israel. You hate the Israeli God. You hate the Israeli people, and you hate the state of Israel. So that's the situation. The Trumps are obviously Ohave Israel.
Right.
It doesn't matter if they agree or not agree. Just general outlook is that they're Ohev Israel.
Right. I want to say also, since I haven't gotten the chance to talk about this, I really resented the campaign that during the campaign season, which was all about trying to portray Donald Trump as an anti-Semite. I watched the videos because I care about the truth, right? And I'm not dogmatic. If Donald Trump is a hater of Israel, I'm ready to not like him, even though maybe I should be a conservative or this or that, whatever you would want to peg me.
Right.
I don't like an anti-Semite. It really doesn't know. It doesn't matter where he stands politically or right. on anything else. And I don't care. I don't feel obligated to anything else. So I would watch these videos and I would read the articles. And I was just very surprised by how people would try to paint him with that brush. When he so clearly is the kind of person who is maybe a stereotyper, but not necessarily a hater. You know what I mean? And so I, anyway, the truth is, Ishai, that none of us really know what's going to happen. We have an inkling because of what he says.
I know what's going to happen. It's going to be exciting.
It's going to be exciting.
I know it's going to be exciting.
It's going to be exciting. And Barack Obama is an amazing actor. I really think he has a future in Hollywood.
You wrote a meme in one of my articles. I just put out an article in Allgemeiner, which was saying goodbye to President Barack Obama and basically calling him out as an enemy of certainly the I don't know if he's an enemy of Israel per se. I think he is. But one could argue the other side. But one thing is for sure, he's against the Jewish presence in Judea and Samaria, our ancestral homeland, and being against our presence in the ancestral homeland equals denying our history, equals really undermining the anchoring of the state of Israel. And I wrote an article saying, look, on balance, you actually, President Obama, were more successful than I expected. And had three big blows against Israel. One is the big Iran deal. Two is the Jerusalem, the non-recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in a Supreme Court case, which their State Department argued. And finally, these UN Security Council vote against us in the Paris Conference. Just an incredible kind of barrage against the Jewish people's rights in Judea and Samaria. But I said, on the other hand, we fought back, and it wasn't just your you landing punches against us. We landed some punches against you, and we landed one punch is that your beloved Arab Middle East turned on itself because of your lack of leadership, and that was horrific. But at the same time, it also yielded a reality where our enemies became weaker. I also said I've got two. I've seen my sickness is catching up with me. I remember
the Arab Spring and
the Arab Spring was our the Arab Spring, which turned into, as they say, like an Arab winter. That's definitely number one. Number two is that you put, I remember now, Prime Minister Netanyahu, you made him really like a world stage actor. You put him right in front of the world as like a, we became more of a leadership, and Israel became more independent. Israel became more independent in your tenure. We became stronger. We became more aware of the fact that we can't be a puppet state. All that has worked out. Our economics have even grown under your time, even though you, President Obama, tacitly supported BDS. So for many reasons, we actually became a lot stronger. And I predicted this. If you remember, I wrote an article right when President Obama started called Why I Love Barack Obama. Remember that?
Yeah.
And a lot of people were against that. And I said, listen, we're going to grow through this. I was totally right on. The only place that I wasn't right is that he did score some points against us. I thought that he was going to be totally ineffective, but he did
score. Points aren't a big deal.
No, the Iran thing is a big deal. The Iran thing is a big deal. Yeah, he got us.
But that could be reined in again. It would take a lot of money and a lot of time, but yeah, I think it could be reined in.
He hurt us.
And I think that all in all, everyone's very excited about the possibilities with Donald Trump. My prediction, this may not be a very popular prediction, but my prediction is that this actually will really fan the flames of terror. The difference is that I'm not willing to blame the victim, meaning to say, I don't think that there shouldn't be a Donald Trump so that we can stay away from bullies like jihad. Jihad will do what jihad does based on its own calculations and its evil intentions. And therefore, I don't think we should stop doing what we feel we need to do just to appease them, because I don't think that stuff works. But I do think that the initial phase of Trump, and particularly if he moves the embassy or enables the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, move, but rather doesn't stop the will of the American people and does move the embassy to Jerusalem. I do think that there will be a wave of terror. I think that there will be a wave of terror in Israel. God forbid. Hashem should protect all of us individually and together. And I will go ahead and say that I think it will come to the United States. I think that it already has come to the United States, but I think it will be more pronounced. I think that Donald Trump is a much bigger threat to jihad than Barack Obama, who was an appeaser and at the best case scenario and an enabler in the worst case scenario. And so the jihad, when it feels a threat, it doesn't just run away. First, it comes to see if you're tough and if you're going to stand up to it. And so it will attack. And I do think jihad will attack.
All right. The question is then, are we going to push back? And that's really.
Yeah. So that's the response. We've got to push back and we got to smash it. And then I think if we all succeed in doing that, then I think that we will have done a massive favor, not just for ourselves, but for everyone else on earth who feels too afraid to deal with the problem.
Right. Listen,
what do you think?
No, there's only one way with bullies. I don't know. I mean, I think
you have a prediction. Or you don't believe in predictions.
I think predictions is a great game. You know, it's a great game. It's one of the great games in town. I was just talking about my previous prediction about
Barack Obama,
the Barack Obama period and how I was gloating about how I was partially, right. And it's fun to write predictions and to think about that, because that keeps it exciting. It helps you plan for the future. I think you make a good point that it could be very, very well that very true that the jihad would want to rise up, but with the move to the embassy of Jerusalem and so forth, and the whole more nationalistic right wing power coming to be. But on the other hand, I actually would like to think that the jihad is in its downward spiral. It's really past its peak. It has no internal truth anymore.
Did it have internal truth?
You know, it had a certain kind of, it had... The Arab world hasn't produced anything. It hasn't created anything. And it's just this kind of force of darkness. There's a famous midrash about this great whale at the end of times, the great whale fighting the great bull, and that they actually would cancel each other out and then Israel would arise. And I always understood the great whale being Islam, this like big force of darkness that wants to put a big veil over us. This whale is like this big dark thing in the dark sea, and it wants to kind of swallow you up and put a darkness. And the bull is, of course, the bull market. You know, the bull is America. America is Merrill Lynch. It's that bull. It's that whole thing. And they like I think if anything, like, Donald Trump is that bull. He's that red bull. He's that, like,
he is the market.
Right. He's the market. Exactly. He is
Lord Business.
Right. President Business.
President business.
And he, you know, that's from the Lego Movie. But
best,
you know,
movie, by the way. Right. We don't usually recommend movies on this show, but. Yeah. Best movie ever.
That and Fiddler on the Roof. Fiddler on the Roof still will teach you many incredible lessons. Mark and I were just discussing a lesson from Fiddler on the Roof. Any case, you know, yeah, I think that there's a reckoning. I don't know. You know, I'm not one of these people who likes to be like, you see, this is the Bible coming true. I don't like to thump the Bible exact. Like, I do it, but not like on like end days stuff. I like to see the Jewish people in gathering and the
right.
And
you're
the
not
period.
Apocalyptic.
No, exactly. Thank you, Malka. Thank you. I don't like to do it, but I do sense a potential, like, there's a tremor in the force. That's all I could say.
Right. I mean, it's just too, like, it's too interesting. It's like this businessman who is not accountable to anyone and his beautiful daughter who comes up the ranks. And then suddenly she's Jewish and she brings this Jewish guy in and she and her kids are Jewish and they care about Israel. And it goes from being like a country that's going towards hating Israel to a country that possibly goes towards loving Israel. Bidiuk, exactly when there's a huge jihad wave way over here.
And on American campuses, don't forget.
Right, that's a
horrible
thing.
And on American campuses. Yes. All right, Malka, we're going to take a tiny little break. Very, very small break. Don't touch that dial, if you know what I mean. Don't touch that iPod. Don't touch that podcast. Don't touch that any way you listen to it. We're going to be right back after these little ads. And Malka, it's time for a little bit of guidance of the big H, Hashem.
Right.
To give us a little...
Give a little Torah portion.
Torah portion, which of course has so much to do with the very week that we're living in. A new king is coming. Hopefully the new king that's coming in America is not like the new pharaoh that came to Egypt. We'll discuss that and more right after this.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome. I'm not feeling so good today, Baruch Hashem. Thank you, God, for not feeling good. And therefore, I'm at home recording with Malka Fleischer, my beloved show hostess with the mostest.
It's fun for me to be on your show, Yishai.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. You're on my show, like, our whole life, you're on my show. And I try to be on your show. Let's talk about the Torah portion. It's totally foundational for the next four books. This is a key. This is a key Torah portion. It's a complete shift. Truth is, I love being with you, but I really do miss Rabbi Mike Foyer.
Sure.
To help us deal with this. But we'll get there.
That's okay.
I'll try to make some jokes
or something. And
no. Don't misunderstand.
I don't know. Maybe also be fun.
No, you'll
be crying on the inside.
Do not cry. Do not be in any way upset. It's just that this
well,
is.
Well, I'm a little bit upset because I do not like to leave the book of Bereshit. I always get a little bit sad when we're getting already deep into the story of the Jewish people in Israel and in Egypt. And that is a cool story too. And, you know, people who love Passover, they love this story also.
I love the
Bereshit stories, the Genesis stories with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, especially Abraham. I'm the kind of person who, when I watch the movie, I like the happy beginning before all the angsty stuff happens.
Right.
And now we're getting right into the angsty stuff.
Well, this is as angsty as it gets. The Jewish people went down to Egypt. Joseph was taking care of them, and everything was going around swimmingly. And the Jewish people were in exile from the land because of this famine. But things were going right. Suddenly, they start to take a very bad turn. a whole generation of the founders passes away, generation of Joseph, a new king rises in Egypt. And it says that the Jewish people were fruitful, teemed, increased, and became strong, very, very much so, and the land became filled with them. So they were very successful in Egypt, and they started really propagating there. Just an interesting thing for you, Malka, you should know the words "v'temaleh ha'aretz otam," the land was filled with them, appears in only one other place in the whole Torah, and it says "v'temaleh ha'aretz chamas."
Ooh.
There's only two options.
And either, we all know you don't even need a translation of Hamas if you don't speak Hebrew, because you know what Hamas is.
Right, but Hamas actually in Hebrew actually means what the Hamas organization wants to call itself, which is it means like violence. It means like violent crime. And basically what the Torah is telling us is that it's either the land is going to be filled with them, the Jewish people, or it's going to be filled with Hamas. On the deepest level, what it means "v'temaleh ha'aretz" means the land itself was filled with them. The Medrash goes on to say that in the times where of Noah, when the land was filled with Hamas, what it meant is that even underground passages were filled with criminality. And that's just like the rockets, that the underground passages that Hamas makes in order to fire rockets at Israel.
Right.
As opposed to "v'temaleh ha'aretz otam," that same Gaza Strip that became filled with these tunnels was once filled with Jewish children playing and growing amazing fruits and vegetables and flowers and exporting them to the world. So you got really two options. And that's another thing connected to our last half. It's like it's either going to be like a Barack Obama, or it's going to be a good President Trump. Like there's two options there, either Hamas or Otam. In any case, a new king rises up in Egypt. He gets very nervous about the Jewish people being large, and he starts to enslave them, putting taskmasters over them, and he starts to make the Egyptians enslave the children of Israel. They embittered their lives with hard work, with mortar, with bricks, and with every labor in the field, and all their labors that they performed, they were with crushing harshness. And then not only are they enslaved in terms of work, but they're also going to be, there's going to be a horrible kind of Holocaust against the Jewish male babies. And that is an edict of Pharaoh that the male babies should be killed. Two Jewish midwives, Shifra and Pua, some people say that's Yocheved and Miriam, the mother and sister of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, basically undermine that edict and save a lot of the Jewish children. But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt had spoken to them, and they caused the boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing that you have caused the boys to live?" The midwives say to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are unlike Egyptian women, for they are experts. Before the midwife comes to them, they have already given birth." And God benefited the midwives, and the people increased and became very strong. So there's a whole discussion about the midwives and about childbirthing. And there's this horrible edict against Jewish babies. Like Jewish babies are being thrown into the Nile to be eaten by the crocodiles or to drown. It's like such a horrific thing. And another thing that Jewish women here do, the Midrash says, is that they use Jewish sexuality to beautify themselves, cause themselves to be attractive, and to overcome the incorrect decision that the Jewish men had to not procreate because they saw that Jewish men were dying, the Jewish baby boys were dying, and the Jewish women continued to kind of use femininity in order to cause the Jewish people to continue to propagate and to certainly have girls at the time, but just try to have the children and not stop the procreative process. So there's two very strong kind of heroine moments for Jewish women to propagate and continue the Jewish race. I thought that you might have something to say about that, being the fact that you're a midwife and birth coach.
A birth coach. I'm not a midwife. I'm a birth coach. What do I have to say about that? You know, thumbs up. I think that Shifra and Pua not only did help Jewish women to have their babies, clearly, but then they were politically astute in their dealings with Pharaoh. It doesn't say, by the way, that Pharaoh was like, "You're lying. It was just like Pharaoh was. It basically says that they knew how to go help women have babies quietly and smartly. And then they went back to Pharaoh and gave him a story. And so therefore, they actually ended up saving lots of Jewish babies, probably. We know, those of us who learn Torah, that the generation of people who were enslaved in Egypt were a big mess, basically. And we know from the stories that come after they're freed that the Jewish people had a lot of PTSD after they came out of there and had a very hard time cooperating with Moses, with God in basic things and in more than basic things. And there was a big mess in the desert of Sinai until the Jewish people got to Egypt. But we know that between the enslavement and making it to the land of Israel, that the Jewish women took a very, very strong role. Even though Moses and Aaron were the two really primary leaders of the Jewish people in the desert, and then Joshua afterwards, the Jewish women as a populace are mentioned numerous times throughout the Torah and hinted at numerous times during those stories for their strength, for their faith, for their courage, for their wisdom in understanding what was happening to them when they were freed from Egypt. And so during this period too, the Jewish men in their slavery, no offense to you guys, kind of choked. And the Jewish women managed to keep it together and managed to do a lot of quiet and intelligent leadership within the nation and within their families to keep things going until they could be rescued, basically. And we know that the Jewish women, for example, were the ones to get the Torah first. There are numerous reasons that we know that. We know that the Jewish women survived the desert trek all the way to Israel and made it into the land of Israel. And we know that many, many men between the ages of 20 and, well, basically all the men between the ages of 20 and 40 during the time of freedom.
20 and 60.
20 and 60, excuse me, thank you. Between 20 and 60, they were killed off, basically, by God over the course of time. And so we learn that the Jewish women did these things and that they were rewarded. And until today, Jewish women take these stories that begin with now, basically. We take these stories as a powerful message about how Jewish women should operate in society.
Very good. Okay. So there's going to be a very special baby going to be born to a special Jewish family, and that is Levites. And these Levites, it's going to be Yocheved. It says, and the man went from the house of Levi and took a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son. She saw that he was good, and she hid him for 3 months. And this goodness is going to be an unusual goodness. So this is going to be a higher level goodness.
All women think that, right, that their child exhibits a lot of goodness.
Right.
And you could take that story either way, two ways, really, Yishai. One is that you could say that this kid seemed extra good, right? There was a goodness, like a capital G goodness, that was too good to ignore, and she had to do something. Another angle I think you could take also is that she just had the regular motherly feelings about her child, but she did something daring that the other women didn't manage to do, which is that she concocted this wild and very improbable plan to create a basket and float it down a river and try to get it rescued. And it's a brilliant story, and it worked.
Right. And she sends this, we have this baby Moses. We don't know his name yet, but he's going to be sent down the Nile. And this is reminiscent of another ark. This is an ark, but this is an important thing to know, is that there's a relationship between Noah, who was in an ark, and Moses, who was in his own little personal ark. And we'll talk about that later. And anyway, he sent down the river, and he's going to be rescued by the daughter of Pharaoh, Bitya. And she, in the end, according to Jewish the Midrash, is going to convert. She reaches out. Somehow there's another like mystical moment here that her hands kind of get lengthened and she gets a long reach to get baby Moses. out from the reeds that he's stuck in. And I want to add here that that there's a famous verse here. It says, "V'hine na'ar boche," and here and indeed there was. Behold, there was a youth crying. And it says, "V'tiftach," she opened it, and she saw him, and here he was, a child crying. And I heard one of your favorite rabbis, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau, make an interpretation on this verse. This is a very hard verse to understand. She opened it, and she saw here was a crying child. What's weird about that is that she should have heard him, or should have heard him before he opened. So he said such a thing. I gotta pull it together here, not to choke up. He says this is about the Holocaust. He says, in the Holocaust, when we were hiding, we were children, we were crying, but we learned how to cry silently. And this was what was happening here, a Holocaust. And when she opened up, she saw the child crying, but he was doing it silently.
Because he learned that he has to be quiet.
Right, like Jewish kids in hiding in the Holocaust. And that's what she opened it up. She's like, this is a Jewish kid. Now I know it's a Jewish kid because they see he's crying, but he's doing it silently. That's what Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau said. Any case, baby Moses is rescued. He gets somehow his mother becomes his nursemaid, but he grows up as a, you guys know it, prince of Egypt, son of Pharaoh, right? And everything is going good until one day he sees a Jew, and somehow he understands that somehow he learns, we don't really get told how, he gets learned that he is a Jew also. He understands that the people being beaten all around him and being enslaved are his brothers. He sees their hardships, and he sees an Egyptian hitting a Hebrew, one of his brothers. He turns this way and that way. He sees that there isn't a person. So some people, the simple meaning is he sees nobody's looking. Other people say, he says, he sees there's nobody else but me. There's nobody else but me. Ein ish. There's nobody else but me to do it. Vayachat ha-mitzri. He hits the Egyptian. He kills him. And he buries him in the sand. The next day, after he does that, two Jews are fighting, and he tries to break them up. And they're like, what, are you going to kill one of us like you did to the Egyptian? And that was his first foray into
Jewish politics.
Jewish politics, right? That's it. And then, of course, he has to run away, and he's like, you know, this is like a, like, it's almost like you're trying to be like a Knesset member, and you get burnt out. Instead, you go to, like, New Zealand, forget it, I don't need any of this stuff. And he ends up going far, far away to Midian. But here is one of my favorite stories in that he rescues, famously, the Midianite, the daughters of Jethro, who are trying to water their flock. And Moses is trying to rescue them from these other sheepherders who are, you know, abusing these women and trying to get in front of them to get the water, until Moses comes around, and then one sheepherder says to the other sheepherder, let's get the flock out of here. And what happens is that God sees what kind of person Moses is. Because in the first story, when he's rescuing one of his brothers from being hit, that's like one thing. Okay, you see your own brothers being hit. But here you come to Midian and you're protecting these women, these strangers. You don't even know the backstory. You're getting involved here and you're protecting the weaker class from the stronger. Maybe you should side with the stronger, you know? That'll be more politically astute. But he fights for the underdog. And this, I think, where liberal Jews get a lot of their energy from. Like, there's a beauty in fighting for the underdog. And that's what Moses is really about. He's all about fighting for...
well, he's into doing what's right, no matter what.
Right. Exactly. Anyway, so God is, like, impressed with him. Certainly the Midianite daughters are impressed with him, and so is Jethro. He marries Jethro's Tzipora. She's very strong. She's a strong woman. And then God is going to reveal himself to Moses. God hears the cry of the Jewish people. He remembers, and this Torah portion, by the way, speaking, you said earlier that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you love those stories. Well, the term Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is going to be full in this Torah portion. It's a recurring theme here. It's constantly, he says, Vayishma Elohim et nakatam. God heard their cries, Vayiskor Elohim et brito, and Hashem is going to remember his covenant et Avraham et Yitzchak et Yaakov, et Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There's going to be a recurring theme here. I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So there's going to be a big tie-in to the book of Genesis. Any case, then there's a big scene of the revelation of the burning bush, right? The burning bush, there's a fire, but the fire isn't being consumed. To me, fire not being consumed is perpetualness, perpetuity.
Hmm.
Perpetuity. That's what God is. It's like there's an energy, and it doesn't have a beginning and an end. It doesn't run out. It doesn't convert into something else. It's like, I'm the master of energy. I have endless, boundless energy and light. And I can even convert this world that you see into something much more incredible. So there's like a vision here of, you know, of renewable energy for the future. You know, there's like, I am the God of all this incredible power. And he says to him, Moses, you gotta go down. Go down to Egypt land. Let my people go, right? Go down there, Egypt. Go down. Moses is constantly going to try to back out. He's going to say, I don't speak well. People won't know. What's your name anyway? God's going to say, my name is I will be that which I will be. That's my name. That's my name for generations. You can't make rules on me. I'll do it my way. And I'm sending you, boy.
Oh, it's another song.
which song
is that? I'll do it my way.
I did it my way. And he says, I'm going to take you to the land, the good land, the land of milk and honey. But it's going to be a land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. But I want you to go down there. And Moses is going to be very distrusting, Malki. He's going to be very distrusting until God says, listen, let me give you signs. And he's going to give him three signs. The first one, very famous, is, first sign, take your staff, throw it down.
Oh, and it becomes a snake.
It becomes a snake. Okay? What does the snake symbolize? It symbolizes Egypt itself. It's really either a crocodile or a snake. And he says, and Moses is like, whoa, that's as dangerous like a snake. And he's like, no, grab it by the tail. And it becomes a stick in his hand. I think what it means is, you see, you'll be able to control Egypt. You see? You can grab it by the tail and it's yours. You're going to be able to handle the snake. Don't worry about it. You'll be able to totally control Egypt. And the next thing is he says to him is, stick your hand into your, put your hand into your coat, take it out, and it's all like white, right? So Moses is like, oh my God, you're like a god of punishment, right? And then he's like, no, put it back in again, take it out, and it's all whole again. The answer there, God says to him, is, you think the Jewish people may have become too grimy, slimy, dirtied, sullied in Egypt? No, I'll be able to heal them. I'll be able to bring you back to wholeness, right? I'll be able to make you into the nation. I'll be able to forge you. I can do that. And finally, he says to him, I want you to take a cup of water from the Nile and pour it on the ground, then it becomes like blood. What is that? What does that sign mean? I can control, I can make water into blood? What he says to him is, the Holocaust that happened won't be forgotten. I remember. I know that what looks like water, underneath that is blood. I know they threw the Jewish kids in, and I'm going to avenge it. I'm going to avenge it. That's what I think it means when he pours the water and it becomes blood. It's like, I know that beneath this water
right,
is
it's
blood.
Not all clear and pretty.
Right. I know what the truth is. You don't have to worry. I'm a God of memory. I will remember the truth, and I will remember all the souls. I'll remember the blood that was spilled. But Moses has a very hard time accepting all this. He has a very, very hard time accepting all this. And finally, God is going to, he gives him the whole vision. He says, I'm going to strike all of Egypt with all of my wonders. Right. And at the end, I'm going to, the Egyptians are going to actually like you and respect you. And they're going to give you like presents and you're going to leave wealthy from Egypt. Like he gives him the whole narrative, which is very helpful. You know, it's very helpful to have a
preview.
A preview and an end goal. Like, you know, where you're going with this thing. But in any case, finally, Moses is on the road, and then suddenly a really weird thing happens. It seems like Moses' own son is going to be attacked by some kind of snake, some kind of like thing that wants to swallow and kill him. And it says that God wanted to kill his son. What does that even mean? And I think what it means, Malka,
and then
is
Tzipora gave him a Brit Milah, and then he was saved.
Right, Tzipora like takes a flint rock,
and she like
pantses
him and
right in a private place, and
what
and,
that was like.
Right, and she's like, "You're a bridegroom of blood to me," and it's like, "What is going on here?" Well, first thing, we keep it exciting, okay? Nobody's gonna make this book is gonna be like exciting, but it's also the people say that he was that he had not circumcised his children yet. And that she knew that God was angry about that he had not like taken the time to one could make a whole educational Dvar Torah out of this by saying you got to focus on your kids first before you go rescue the children of Egypt. You got to make sure that they're Jewish and strong before you're going to bring them down into this gullus, this in this den of iniquity. But I think another meaning is that God was actually angry at Moses a little bit. He was angry at him for being too blithe about the rescue operation that he needed him for. He just a bit too much protested. And God's like, you know what it is about you, Moses? You know what you don't get? You don't get the pain of your children dying on your own flesh. Your brothers and sisters, they have that, but you don't feel the pain. I want you to understand what it means. And he almost like, either in anger or more like as a teaching thing, almost kills Moses' son. In order for you to understand, and I will say to even listeners of the show, sometimes, like last Sunday, and this week as well, there was this week a police officer was killed,
that's right,
murdered, and last week four Israeli soldiers were murdered, and we just go on with our merry day, and you know we don't understand that for every one of those families, that's a Holocaust. That's
absolutely
a Holocaust that happened. And Moses was a little, when God's like, I need you to go down and do this for me, Moses is like, yeah, send somebody else. God's like, you know what I think about you? I think that maybe
sense the urgency.
You don't sense the urgency. And I need you a little bit more to understand this. And so that's what happens. But in the end, when Moses goes down to Egypt, what happens is that Moses is like, I don't know what you're talking about. I never heard of your God. And he makes the life of the Jews much more bitter. And we also learned that there were Jewish capos who were working for Pharaoh, and they were striking the Jews. Then they came to Pharaoh, and they're like, why did you make it harder for us? Why did you take away he said, you have to make the same amount of bricks, but there's no more
straw.
By the way, think about that now in conjunction with the fire that didn't go out, the burning bush, right? The burning bush is like fire. There's like a fire, and it never goes out.
Right.
There's like perpetual energy. Here it's like build bricks, but I won't give you with wherewithal. I won't give you anything to build it with. And it's like it's like that's what Pharaoh is. It's like, go make it ex nihilo, make it something from nothing. I don't care how you find it. And he doesn't want to provide. God, on the other hand, is like forever providing energy, forever giving us, renewed energy. And at the end of that Torah portion, the Jews are complaining against Moses. They're like, you have only done bad. And then Moses will up that complaint up to God and be like, you sent me, and since I came, it's only been worse for the Jews. You did not rescue them at all. And God says to him, now you'll see my wonders. Okay? You're going to see what I'm going to do in Egypt. And that's where the Torah portion ends. It's like, dun, dun, dun.
But
like
To
be continued. At first, it was like a little bit harsh. Also, when the state of Israel was born, and even now, sometimes people are like, oh my God, you're like, what do you need it for? It's like, now we focused all anti-Semitism on us, and who needs it? And it's a mess, and it's dirty, and it's problematic. Like, the process is not always beautiful. You know, the process here of redemption was like, it went down before it went up. It got way worse before it got better. So sometimes, like, another thing the Torah portion teaches us is you have to have some patience through the process. The process isn't always beautiful. So that's Malka, the
wow,
Torah portion of Shemot, the names of the Jewish people, and the whole book is called like the names. I think the more appropriate is the English version, Exodus.
Yeah.
Movement of Jewish people. You know, they they're coming out of Egypt, but first, you know, there's a lot of struggle. There's the rescue of Moses, there's the growth of Moses, and there's even his reticence. And this incredible strong family that he comes from that really gave him a lot, his father-in-law, his incredible wife. He meets his brother Aaron in the desert, it says about him that who was a three-year older brother. It was older than Moses, and yet he was not jealous of him at all. In fact, he was happy. And I want to add one last thing, which is that Moses says to God, I am heavy of speech. A lot of people like to say that he says that I'm a stutterer. I'm not good at talking. I don't find in the Torah one place that it says that he was a stutterer. He says, I'm heavy of speech, meaning to say, in Hebrew today, say, you're talking a little heavy on me. You're coming heavy. You're coming down heavy on me. Moses' thing was that he would be a straight talker. He was too straight. He was too straight when he talked to people. He'd be like, we saw it in this week's Torah portion. He's like, you're a Rasha, Rasha. Why do you hit the other guy? Hey, evil dude, why are you doing this? You know, he would be like, too doogree, as we say in Israel. Too straight up. Too straight talk express. Right, for real. Too straight up. God is, at the end, God's like, no problem. I'll get you a diplomat. You'll be the straight talk express, and we'll get you a diplomat. That's Aaron. Aaron is not the straight talk express.
Listen, Pharaoh.
Come on, you know.
You guys are great.
Yeah.
We have some things, and we gotta go.
Right.
I always think it's interesting that Moses even gets an audience with Pharaoh at all. Pharaoh is the leader of the non-free world at that time. He's the head of everything. You would think, you know, if I'm trying to get in to see Donald Trump, I could try tweeting a lot, right? That might do it. But basically, if I want to actually go see the man, I have to go through about 70 layers of people in order to get to him. Whereas Moses, he goes to Egypt and suddenly he's standing before Pharaoh and they're having a schmooze and they're doing snakes and all kinds of stuff.
But he's the prince of Egypt.
So that's what's cool, is that Moses comes from the family. And so he has access.
Right. Yes. This Torah portion is very much about access. That's for sure. You know what? You reminded me that is true. One of the famous scenes that all the movie makers like is that indeed he does show them he does throw down the staff. And that throwing down the staff in front of Pharaoh, and at the same time, Pharaoh's magicians do the same thing, and of course, the staff of Moses will swallow up the snake of Moses will right. swallow up the other snakes. Like he said before, like we will control it. We will control it in the end. You're absolutely right. He did get access, Malka, and we get a lot of access inside when we read this Torah portion. It gives us a front row view. Malka, what's your view, by the way, on the videos we have here in our house? Two different videos, one called Prince of Egypt and the other one.
Oh, the Exodus-type movies.
Yeah, what's
children?
The other one called? The ones that
one is the Prince of Egypt. One is called, like, I don't know what it's called, and I don't know where we got it. Somebody handed us over this movie.
Is it called Ten Commandments or something?
I think it's called The Ten Commandments, but it's a children's movie.
Right.
It's not the Charlton Heston movie, which we also have. What do I think about these things? Look, different people have different ways of looking at this stuff. Are these the real, true, honest-to-goodness stories of the Exodus? No. Was Ramses even the Pharaoh? Probably not, right? The Pharaoh probably had a different name. His name wasn't Ramses. And all these movies are kind of copying each other and not being very original and adding backstory. And I get particularly offended in the movie The Prince of Egypt by the way that they treat Aaron. They make him into a total jerk. And instead, Aaron's like one of the most amazing and level-headed people that ever existed on planet Earth. So I resent that. I still introduce those films to my children with lots of warning, right? And we talk about how the Bible differs from the movies that they see. But I still really appreciate that these movies are on the topic. And I think that it makes my kids relate to the stories of the Bible more and to take interest in the characters of the Bible. And I continue to, you know, discuss with them, for example, the Aaron character in The Prince of Egypt. I tell them how very, very different it is. And so it also gives them a perspective on movie making because they understand that these movies are not trustworthy. You can't just watch a movie and like believe what you see when you watch TV because the makers of films and television shows, they come at it with their agendas and their goals. And so you have to be cautious in what you consume. Yeah, that's where I stand.
Malka, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Ishai Fleischer Show. I know it was I really pulled you in to do a lot of Torah portion with me today. I appreciate that.
Well, I enjoyed it.
I want to tell
you, it's a great Torah portion.
It is an amazing Torah portion. It's really the foundation of this. And really, we're going to get back to the Exodus from here on. The next four books of the Torah are going to be involved with Moses, who we're going to meet in this week's Torah portion, and with the Exodus. It's always going to harp back to that. And so much of Judaism harps back to the Exodus. And in some ways, one could think of our whole religion as being the Exodus religion. It's a whole.
Well, this is definitely how a lot of the nations of the world relate to us. I don't know if, I mean, we remember the coming out of Egypt as a weekly and even a daily thing. You're supposed to remember that the Jewish people were taken out of Egypt and take it personally, like it happened to you. So it is very, very foundational. But I think also the message that the world got about the Jews was in large part colored by this one particular event, which is that the Jewish people were victims and that a hero was empowered by God to take them out. And then they became like an awesome kung fu nation in their land with their amazing book. And like, that's when progress started, basically.
That's right. And everybody was
kung fu
fighting.
And a lot of people take hope from the story of the Exodus.
By the way, just one more thing before we end off. You showed me a video of a pastor in America.
Yes.
Who speaks against the Jews.
Yes.
He looks like the nicest fella.
I think he's from Arizona.
Right, he's from Arizona. He seems like the nicest fellow. And yet his whole teaching is about...
He's a raging anti-Semite.
But with a religious basis.
Well, he uses the New Testament primarily, but he tries to hearken back to the Old Testament, of course, all in English with the translations of whoever translated it for him. And he tries to use the Christian texts and the Jewish Torah to disprove the goodness, the worth of the Jews, in particular Israel also. He's a hater.
He's a Sone
Israel.
And
he has a lot of videos.
He is a Sone Israel.
Yeah, he's a super duper Sone Israel.
He's a hater of Israel.
He's like a Nazi.
And you could see that you could use the Bible, you could use all kinds of ways.
Anything could be twisted, basically.
That's
right. You could take any good thing and twist it around.
That's right. So if you folks have a heart for Israel, as we say, keep it up. Keep up that heart. Keep
right,
up
and write to us also. You know, we like to hear from you.
Definitely. I'd like to hear from you. Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I want to thank the Michel family so much for helping support this show. I want to thank my good friends in Brooklyn who make this show happen. Okay, my friend Sarah, my friend Lillian, my friend Jack, my friend Moshe, my friend Nathan, all my good friends out there. I want to thank all the people who support my friend my good friend in Atlanta, Georgia, who helps so much happen here in Israel for us, all the good things that happen for us, and my friend Donnie here in Jerusalem. Many good people are making this show happen. I want to thank Moshe Herman for being a producer of the show, Ben Bresky for editing, and Tabitha for doing so much of thelandofisrael.com's uploading and
Dr.
emailing.
Dr. Jeff out in Australia.
That's right, Dr. Jeff, my brother in Australia. And so many more good people. I haven't heard from you in a while. Please write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Malka Fleischer, I want to thank you again for not only being on the show, but helping me feel better through
yes,
my mini flu here.
Soon,
thank you very much. God bless all of you out there. Let us exodus from whatever darkness wants to encompass us and hold us down. Let us exodus from all the things that want to keep us small and keep our vision small. There are huge things happening. Right now is the time to be involved in the story. So let us break free of the bondage that's keeping us down. Let us be part of the story of Israel. It is a huge story. And you'll see that if you just activate yourself, if you become part of the story, you'll see the sea is going to split right in front of you. God bless you, folks. Shabbat shalom. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Malka, thanks again.
Shabbat shalom.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you are a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with HaYovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to hayovel.com.